from KQED.
Hey, everybody, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Today on The Breakdown, after a year of talking about the recall of Governor Gavin Newsom quite a bit, we're going to talk about it just one more time. I promise.
Well, maybe.
Well, probably not. But with the guy who engineered the hugely successful campaign to defeat it.
That's right. Political consultant Juan Rodriguez managed a very well-funded effort to save Gavin Newsom's job using, we'll talk with him about all this, but a robust digital campaign, get out the vote plan, and so on to maximize Democratic turnout. Got a little help from a couple people named Biden and Harris to crush the recall. And
one of whom he used to work for.
Yes, and with, and yes. So we'll talk about all that, but let's talk about the recall first.
Yeah, but first, let's talk about the recall without Juan, so he can tell us everything we got wrong.
So, isn't it weird that we have for months been talking and thinking and speculating about this, and now it's over, and everything's kind of the same. You know, the problems are the same. I mean, things are different. Obviously, the political landscape is different. But in terms of what we, you know, have as a state to confront and our daily lives, not much has changed. We're still dealing with the pandemic, still trying to put those wildfires out, still got
it's
homeless on the streets.
Almost like maybe we shouldn't have spent
$276 million later. But, obviously a lot has transpired. And, you know, we'll talk with Juan about this, of course. But, there was a moment in August, where everybody was who cared about Newsom beating back the recall was kind of freaking out
a little bit.
But then, you know, you also look back at the PPIC polls and things really didn't change at all.
No, it was about engagement, which we knew from the beginning. But I do think, I mean, I actually, not to make this all about me, Scott, but
again,
no. It was just funny because I was on vacation in July and I came back and that poll came out and I was like, wait, what happened? Wait, we're worried about this now? Like it was this moment. And I think that it did motivate folks. I mean, to me, the most interesting kind of thing about this stepping back is really thinking about the messaging by both parties and what it sort of portends for next year. And I think that what we saw is this sort of evolution where last winter it was a lot of anger, mostly on the right, but not only, over those lockdowns and the COVID response that kind of helped fuel getting this on the ballot. And in the final months of this campaign, Democrats really flipped that on its head and they embraced that and said, yeah, we kept the state safe. And if you look at the CDC numbers, despite some of our callers on election night, California's doing really well.
It is doing really well. And it's funny because, you know, remember, originally the conventional wisdom was, let's wait until, say, November to have this recall election. Democrats were saying that way, the pandemic will be behind us. There won't be any more wildfires. And yet, as it turned out, the fact that the Delta variant emerged as it did really helped Newsom keep his job because, as you say, not only did California do a pretty good job under his, you know, leadership of containing the virus, but with Larry Elder in the race, suddenly there was Texas and Florida, which were, you know, bright red on those maps of COVID outbreaks. And so that really changed everything.
Yeah, and I just wonder, like, I do feel like this was something that Republicans had felt would have a lot of potency. And I just, when you look at the numbers, like, it's not like just Democrats have gotten vaccinated, even though this has become a culture war. And so it just really makes me wonder, like, if that message, like what that message looks like in 22. Obviously, it depends on where we are with the virus, but it is fascinating. I guess what I want to know is, like, does that mean recall fever is over, Scott?
No, it does not at all. In fact, there's many of them going on across the states still, including here in San Francisco with the district attorney, Chesa Boudin, facing a recall. But we did find out this week that the DA in Sonoma County, who had also been facing a recall, funded by one disgruntled human being, a developer, went crashing down, I think it was last I heard 70-30 or something like that, or even higher,
I think even higher
on the
yeah.
no vote. And then in Los Angeles, another district attorney, George Gascon, who's faced a recall potential almost before taking office, that one apparently has fizzled. It doesn't look like they're going to get the signatures. However, the backers of that one say, oh, we're going to come back with a new one. We're going to rebrand our recall. But it does make you wonder. I mean, clearly,
LA is so big.
LA is so big.
You
need a lot
of
signatures.
I mean, yeah, and I do think, like, this is, I mean, the prosecutors are a whole other question, right, than, like, a gubernatorial recall. But I wonder on that, like, crime was something, again, like COVID, that Republicans really tried to use in this recall. And I'm not here to say people aren't concerned about crime and we don't have challenges, especially around quality of life issues like homelessness and you know, more petty theft and things like that. But, like, that is not at the top of voters' minds when you poll them. It did not seem to catch fire in this race. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to watch how this plays out, especially in San Francisco, where the threshold is lower. So Chase Abudin may, you know, it's more likely that that would qualify than the LA one ever looked like. Is that something that people are angry enough? And can they pin it on one prosecutor?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and once again, it will come down to turnout. Who is going to vote? Who's going to be the most mobilized to vote? And you're probably going to have another oddly timed election, a time when people aren't used to voting. And so we'll see. I mean, I do think it is a little closer to home, literally and figuratively, crime. And I do think that those videos that went viral, I don't even want to give all
that. Yeah, we'll get into that later.
But I think we'll see. You know, it's but clearly, you know, all of this has fueled talk in Sacramento about changing the recall process. It's 110 years old. It's a little creaky, little antiquated.
Right.
And clearly what the framers, so to speak, had in mind, Hiram Johnson et al., this is not, I don't think, it, you know, where you've got multiple, like $100 million plus dollars being spent for and against a recall. And it's just, I think most people would agree, at least in the last Berkeley IGS poll, that it's maybe a little too easy to get a recall on the ballot. And then that second part of the ballot where, you know, the person who comes in first with, it could be 25% of the vote, could end up being governor. And so we'll see if that gets any traction up in Sacramento.
Yeah, for sure. We'll be watching that closely. In the meantime, you talked to the man of the hour today.
Yeah, you know, Governor Newsom is going to have yet another high-profile appointment. Associate Justice Tino Cuellar, who Jerry Brown appointed to the state Supreme Court back in 2014. Very impressive gentleman, born in Mexico. He is going to accept the position as president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Really interesting position and a very well thought of think tank. He's going to be opening up an office in Silicon Valley. They used to have a California office, and they're going to be reopening that. And, you know, he just had a lot to say about how what he's learned as an immigrant living on the border, growing up in Imperial County, and also seeing, you know, all these problems and issues come before him on the court, that it being in California gives you an international framing for all these issues, which I think will serve him well.
Right. But what an interesting decision. I mean, people don't give up those judgeships easily, and it does sort of make you wonder, like, why did he feel, you know, like this would be a bigger potential impact? And
would he have done it if
Newsom had lost?
Well, I guess Newsom would have 38 days to appoint somebody to replace him. But obviously, that's not a problem for him right now. And I should mention just real quick, we did talk to Tino Cuellar in 2020, I want to say.
2020, yep.
So check it out.
We'll put
on
it
our
in
podcast.
The show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. All right. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Democratic political consultant Juan Rodriguez. He managed the very successful No on the Recall campaign. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
I'm Jonathan Hill, host of The Weeds. And I know that politics can feel like a joke, and not always in the ha-ha funny way. On The Weeds, we try to split the difference.
When you think run out of money, you think that we're gonna get to a point where, like, one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all, gotta board up.
Like that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check, and that's all the checks we got, and Social Security is no more.
Check out The Weeds every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And now that the recall is history, we're delighted to have with us today Juan Rodriguez. He's a partner with the political consulting firm now known as Bear Star Strategies. He managed the campaign to defeat the recall of Gavin Newsom, resulting in a huge political win for the governor this week. Juan Rodriguez, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Congratulations.
What have you been up to?
Yeah.
just not taking any naps, talking to folks like yourself.
What? But you've been immersed in this, as we all have, but not like you have, for the last several, almost a year now or more. Looking at the numbers, are things pretty much where you thought they'd be? Or I'm sure they're where you hoped they would be. But, you know, what are your takeaways?
Listen, throughout this process, I was listening to your conversation a little earlier. If you looked at some of the, public polls and even in our internal polls really early on in the process, we've always known kind of a simple theory of the case, which is if Democrats voted that we would win this race and we would defeat the recall. And if you go back to January, February, Democrats weren't really paying attention to this, right? There were some public polls that saw Republican awareness above 70+, and you saw that pretty much stable throughout the process. I have a couple theories of why. We can get back to that in a minute. But Democrats were about 36% in terms of overall awareness. They weren't really paying attention to this. Most were like, Marissa, just traveling, having vacation, or figuring out how to just actually get through this pandemic.
Well, right. I mean, COVID was like all we were thinking about for a while, right?
Exactly. So for us, excited about the turnout. I think a couple things. I personally think, provide a case study in what Democrats across the state and even, nationally should be thinking about as they're going into the midterms. But I think at the end of the day, what it does tell you is, that the overwhelming majority of people in the state really kind of looked at what was at stake and evaluated the job that the governor has been doing through the course of this pandemic and really put not just a stamp of approval, but really kind of pushed back against the two visions that were really on display in this election.
So is that mean that we all, and by I mean consultants, the media, the public, should like stop worrying about polls so much that far out? Or is it more like, did that help you guys that people kind of freaked out in August? Because my sense, sort of anecdotally from talking to Democrats, is that that message of like a concern about turnout did get out to people who maybe were not as engaged at that point.
Yeah, I think without question. I mean, I think to answer your original question, should we stop listening to polls? I think the real answer that everyone, I think, can come to your conclusion on is you can make a poll basically say anything. And you really have to dig into the crosstabs, look at what some of the challenge with some of those polls were, the hypothesis of, what turnout was going to look like, and was there going to be a significant drop off in Democrats actually turning out to vote? That was obviously a possibility. But what it ultimately did do, whether you agreed with it or didn't agree with it, and we had our kind of own view in theory of the case, was that the challenge really was to drive up that awareness. And that level of urgency that some of those public polls created, I think at the end of the day, really woke up the base. And then when you add the combination of that with the, field program that we were able to build and the messaging campaign that we, layered on top of it, I think it's when you really started seeing kind of that activism and folks really, begun to turn out.
I remember back in January, not long after the insurrection, Rusty Hicks, the chair of the Democratic Party, held a news conference online and referred to the recall as a coup attempt, and really we're trying to make it an echo of what had happened at the U.S. Capitol. And there was a tremendous amount of blowback and pushback, and he really walked that back a bit. But what did you guys make of that comment, that statement? I mean, were you part of framing that? And what did you learn from the reaction to it?
Well, listen, I got to give a lot of credit to Rusty. He really kind of went out there and really early on, recognized this for what it was. In California, you've seen voter registration for Republicans drop over the past couple of years. And there are a lot of different reasons why, but we are in a dramatically different place than we were in 2003. So I think his overall messaging and kind of point at the time was really focused on recognizing that if Republicans wanted to win statewide, also look at what was happening nationally, right? We just had election rejection. We had the attempted coup of the Capitol. We had all these things that were coming to surface. And as we were going through the pandemic, what he was highlighting and was trying to do was recognizing the problem we were going to have if the recall qualified, which is how do you wake up the Democratic base? How do you get them energized and recognize that what maybe happened in DC can happen in your backyard? And I think at the end of the day, you got to give him credit for coming out really early and helping organize the party the way he did. And we were really appreciative of that fact for sure.
I mean, the other thing, looking back over the sort of the course of this year, was a lot of, concern over the ground game and the engagement. And particularly, I think since 2020, we've been hearing a lot about engagement of Latinos and voters of color and whether, you know, are they really that base that Democrats can depend on? Can you just talk a little bit about like how you all approach that? Obviously, you are Latino. You are the son of immigrants. You know, I know this is something that you've thought about in all your races, but like, again, like, was the concern valid? And what was the sort of strategy to get out there and actually connect with these voters in a way that they were going to hear, not just like on TV?
Yeah, I mean, this, I can be on this topic for hours. I have so many different thoughts on it. I will say a couple of things. The first is, you know, there was some validity to the claims, right? Whether it was foundations or activists that are constantly feeling like these subgroups, Latinos, you know, African-American, API, are always think of last when you're doing kind of voter outreach, and these field programs ultimately develop last for a variety of different reasons. In California, field campaigns are not traditionally a feature of statewide campaigns because it's incredibly cost prohibitive to run a real efficient program. So, you know, you got to recognize and see some of these folks from where they're at. They're bringing up some real claims that need to be addressed and are sometimes really challenged when you have limited resources. But they were unfounded in a way because for us, because we always knew that our theory of the case was that we needed to drive up turnout, we started investing in field before we even put one ad up on air, whether through digital or on TV. We started developing our distributed organizing program thanks to the work that Tim Tagaris and Sydney and eventually other folks that ended up coming on board like Lindsay Hopkins did, recognizing that it would really have to take off and finally cohere when ballots began to drop in the mail. So we started investing in field really early on. And then I think the second thing is, and you, in talking about Latinos, my one just frustration that we have as a Democratic Party or just even in politics is we always have the same talking point, which is, you know, Latinos care about more than immigration. They're not a monolith. The reality is in California, we don't have homogenous groups in any subset. It was so diverse. But we are, as you know, we've been talking about, have all been going through this pandemic that had global implications. It shut down everyone's ability to actually figure out how to continue to survive. The Latinos were disproportionately impacted through the pandemic. And I think at the end, the combination of having really early investments in field that, you know, really kind of blew up and grew, and investing in community-based organizations that have also been on the front line doing not just, you know, voter registration, but doing outreach in these communities was key for our success, I think.
What do you think the impact of that will be, both for the Republicans, but obviously you're a Democratic consultant, you know, for 2022? I mean, you've put in place all this infrastructure you're talking about in a year that was supposed to be an off year, but now we've got these really important midterms coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple things. If you look at Orange County and if you look at these traditional, you know, more purple type seats where, you know, they've been traditionally a toss up and you see overwhelming support for the governor and beating back this recall, I think that is cause for alarm for Republicans and cause for an opportunity for Democrats to make sure that this infrastructure and this organizing, you know, efforts don't kind of go to waste. So I think from my perspective, it really does provide an opportunity. I do think that the work for the midterm started yesterday. And, you know, having these groups vertically integrated into campaigns and making sure that we're driving up voter participation is going to be a priority for campaigns across the state and frankly, nationally.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED. I'm Marie Salagos here with Scott Schaefer. And our guest today is Juan Rodriguez, who managed the hugely successful campaign to defeat the recall of Gavin Newsom. And I should also say has a great name, the name of my first son. Juan, I mean, this is not the only big campaign you've worked on. You worked on Kamala Harris's successful 2016 Senate run, her unsuccessful run for president in 2020. You worked for former Los Angeles mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. Just before we kind of move on to some other stuff, I'm just curious, like when you do look ahead nationally at 22, there seems to be a lot of concern among, you know, Democrats just the sort of history of midterms is that the party in power often gets kind of walloped in those. I mean, what do you think both Newsom and kind of more broadly Democrats need to be doing to push back on this? Like, what are the lessons beyond what we've already discussed?
Yeah, I mean, I think don't be timid on running on your record, leaning into what you are doing to try to accelerate positive public health outcomes. The pandemic, we may be in a dramatically different position in a year from now, but it's not like anyone's going to completely forget that a year ago, the whole world shut down and we're still going to be dealing with COVID. And there are certain states that are continuing to regress and go backwards. So I think that will be front and center. That is one. The other is the one thing that I think is really unique and makes me optimistic about the Democratic Party is what the governor was able to do in the closing, you know, weeks of this campaign and the broad coalition of, frankly, stars that you have within the Democratic Party, from Bernie Sanders to Elizabeth Warren to AOC to Amy Klobuchar, Barack Obama, and, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. These are all people that are national leaders that are really well known across the country. But he also, you know, focused on bringing up kind of the next generation of leaders, the Alex Padillas, the Robert Garcias, and for Democrats, highlighting those leaders, highlighting that the work that they're doing at the local, at the state and national level should be something that should be celebrated. But for me, I think the biggest lesson is really, not being timid in terms of leaning into your record, specifically on COVID.
Juan, we always on this show like to talk about people's bio a little bit. You have such an interesting life story. Your parents came to the U.S. They fled El Salvador when they were young because of the Civil War. They married, I think, in California. I'm not sure. But tell us a little bit about them.
My parents are the best thing in my life, right? They sacrificed so much just to kind of create an opportunity. You guys were talking about Justice Cuellar, who has a really interesting story. Our stories are, frankly, not, similar, or are actually very similar to a lot of people in California. And my parents decided to leave El Salvador during a time that there was significant civil unrest in the middle of a civil war. And the way I describe my personal story is they, for me, kind of represent my first view into the story of unaccompanied minors, right? We saw a lot of this happen over the past couple of years, particularly under the Trump administration. And you see people making those decisions, not because they're interested in kind of putting themselves in harm's way, but really looking for an opportunity. And my parents gave me exactly that, an opportunity to succeed. And this country has given my family, everything we have.
Well, you grew up, I think you were born in Burbank and grew up in North Hollywood, and your mom cleaned houses. Your dad was a carpenter. I just wonder, like, what was it like? I would assume you probably had a pretty big sort of diversity of socioeconomic exposure within your school and your community. I don't know, like, how did you kind of handle that?
It's interesting. I used to spend a lot of time going with my mom to clean houses when I was a kid. And when I was younger, I hated it. You know, I hated taking, public transportation. I just wanted to be at home playing with my friends. And I didn't really fully appreciate the kind of struggle and the life lessons at the time. And I think the unique opportunities to even just go with her and be exposed into a different world, I think really makes me focused on trying to figure out how to continue to identify and collaborate with, individuals, whether elected officials or my partners or community-based organizations that at the end of the day kind of hold on to some of those progressive values. So the story like mine or Justice Cuellar becomes more of the norm and less of the, an individual that is seemingly unique, but really more representative of what a lot of folks in this country are doing in a variety of different sectors.
Do you like ever have moments where you're like standing with the vice president or the governor in a room full of political elites and just go like, I don't know, how do I get here? Do I feel out of place? Like,
quite a road to travel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I for a second, I had that moment the other day when the vice president came into town and I was standing with the vice president and the governor, and we're about to do an event. And then it kind of kicked into gear the thing that all these folks have mentioned to me one time or the other, which is you just got to make sure that you're not the last. If you have the opportunity to walk in through that door, you got to break that door open and make sure that, several other people, behind you can, go even further than you ever even dreamed of.
Well, and talk about worlds colliding. Marisa mentioned you'd worked for Antonio Villaraigosa when he ran for mayor. And I believe you went to a campaign fundraiser maybe in 2004, and you'd been invited by the family of someone your mom worked for as a house cleaner. Is that right?
Oh, you guys are good at research. Yeah, exactly right. I actually wore my Sunday's Best, the only suit that I could have. I was this super idealistic college student who like thought I knew everything just because I'd just taken a class and got an A in it. So I decided to ask him a couple questions. And that was the first time I met him. And, you know, the one thing that he did that I will never forget was he completely knew I was at a place and was not quite sure what I was doing there. Asked me what I was doing. And I love my mother and my father. So I was like, my mother's in the back, you know, washing dishes, and he went to go introduce himself.
Wow.
Democrats never leave a banquet before going through the kitchen and shaking hands, right?
No, those are the people doing the work. So that's absolutely right.
Those are the voters.
So talk about then, was that sort of the beginning of catching the political bug? I know you had originally planned on like working on Wall Street and maybe buying your mom one of those houses.
Yeah, you know, life isn't linear. That's what I thought I was going to do. My plan was to jump on a plane and move to New York and, you know, go work for Lehman Brothers or some, you know, small little firm. And, you know, things changed. And I realized that, you know, pursuit of money was less important than trying to have an impact in life. And I'm trying to do my best at it. So, you know, you let me know how I'm doing.
Your parents must be proud, though.
I hope so. I hope so.
Speaking of research that we did, you spun records when you were at UCLA. You were a DJ. What kind of music were you playing?
Oh, I was playing everything. I can, you know, I should start working on your segment. I could do your background DJ music.
still into the music?
I want to ask you, though, about...
I love everything. I can, on any given moment, play Rachmaninoff to, like, listen to hip-hop and Biggie and Tupac. So it is pretty eclectic.
Nice. I'm curious about the politics of LA and how you see those compared to, say, the politics of San Francisco. I mean, which David Chu has, we've quoted him many times, said it's like up here, politics is like a knife fight in a phone booth. Whereas in LA, people barely pay attention. They barely vote.
Yeah. You know, San Francisco is a beast all in and of itself. Coming out of San Francisco, you have to really be about rough and tumble and do the works. LA is the same. It's a little bit more tribal, and you also have significant more voter apathy, right? People aren't as engaged, geographically dispersed. A Latino from Boyle Heights is not a Latino from Southern, you know, San Fernando Valley, and vice versa. So I think it's, in that respect, it's really challenging because LA is a world-class city and has the ability to actually move markets, yet voters, for the most part, have a tendency not to be as engaged as you see, you know, voters in San Francisco and other parts of the state. But hopefully with changing of, you know, these elections and trying to consolidate them in more off-year regular held elections, I think we'll hopefully see some increase in that.
So we mentioned that you worked for Villaraigosa, and then, of course, you helped run Newsom's campaigns. Is that ever awkward? They're kind of frenemies or rivals, I would say, in politics.
Listen, yeah, it's sometimes it can get a little awkward. but, you know, this race was absolutely clear. You know, this race was never about Antonio Villaraigosa or any other Democrat versus Governor Newsom. This race from the beginning has been about a guy who believed that, you know, he wanted to microchip the undocumented because it worked for animal control. And the origin of this was because the governor provided healthcare access to the undocumented. So for me, when you isolate these problems on what they really are, it is not very challenging to double down. And I think the governor's been excellent at the work that he's been doing.
All right, Juan Rodriguez, you've earned a little break. Thanks for joining us as your last duty before you get some vacation. So thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
All right, that's it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Brandon Willard. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tovin Lindsay, Ernesto Aguilar, Vinny Tong, Otis Taylor, and Erica Aguilar. I am Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at MLagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening.